Thank you, Father Richard. And if I may say just at the outset that, you know, sometimes when you speak to your secretary and you say, I've got a speech, so keep the evening before free. And then she says, well, maybe we'll put a dinner in there and you might get some inspiration, some last minute inspiration for your speech. But perhaps she isn't as knowledgeable on Northern Irish politics and Catholicism, because last night's dinner was with the Democratic Unionist Party, founded by the Reverend Ian Paisley. And if you see traces of this coming out in the text, it's not intentional. Father Richard, Reverend Fathers and Brothers and Sisters of the Dominican Order, and distinguished ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for inviting me to join you today. It's a pleasure to be back here again at Blackfriars and to speak at the annual Aquinas Lecture. And as Thomas Aquinas is the patron saint of Catholic schools and universities, what better topic to speak on than Catholic education and whether it can not only survive, but thrive as we continue into the 21st century. Ladies and gentlemen, the history of Catholic education in the United Kingdom has not been without its struggles, something the history of Blackfriars tells us. Opened in 1238, the priory developed into a leading educational institution, only to be dissolved by Henry VIII in 1538 during the Reformation. Yet here we all are, some 600 years on. Your very existence here, affirming, of course, that Catholic education can indeed thrive despite some challenges. That we can discuss this issue in 2016, when Catholicism faced such a threat in the 16th century, is a testament to its ability to survive. But that we still have to discuss it is also indicative of the continuing challenges faced. The 21st century, ladies and gentlemen, presents us with new challenges for Catholic education, and it is highly unlikely that they will be the same as those presented in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, or indeed even 20th century. This evening in this text, I want to do three things. First, to explore what we actually mean by Catholic education today. Second, to say something about the context in which that education exists and engages. And finally, something about the challenges that it faces and what it might need to do to thrive. What do we mean by Catholic education? The distinctive Catholic, indeed Christian, approach to education could well be summed up as expanding each person's capacity for love, so that we develop the whole person, nurturing body, mind, and spirit. Speaking last November at the World Congress of Catholic Education in Rome, Pope Francis said, "There are three languages of Catholic education: the head, the heart, and the hands. We must teach students," he said, "to think clearly and to know information. We must teach them to love, have empathy and compassion, and be merciful. We must teach them to put these into action with their works to help improve the world and help their fellow human beings." End of quote. Pope Paul VI issued his declaration on Christian education just over 50 years ago. In it, he set out the core purpose of Catholic schools, writing, "The influence of the Church in the field of education is shown in a special manner by the Catholic school. No less than other schools does the Catholic school pursue cultural goals and the human formation of youth. But its proper function is to create for the school community a special atmosphere animated by the gospel spirit of freedom and charity to help youth grow according to the new creatures they were made through baptism. They develop in baptism their own personalities, and finally to order the whole of human culture to the news of salvation, so that the knowledge the students gradually acquire of the world life and man is illuminated by faith. Pope Emeritus Benedict echoed these sentiments when he visited St. Mary's University back in September 2010, explaining that the fundamental purpose of Catholic education is about forming the human person, equipping him or her to live life to the full. In short, he said, it is about imparting wisdom. And Pope Francis has elaborated upon this important focus on the human aspect of a Catholic education. Speaking at that World Congress in November, he said that education should be promoted in the fullness of humanity, because speaking of Catholic education is equivalent to speaking of humans, of humanism. End of quote. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the essence of the distinctive offer of a Catholic education: to remember the bigger picture, to think about formation in its widest human sense, so that it is not simply about acquiring a trade or a profession, important as they are to modern living. The distinctive offer is about living a fulfilled life and about forming people of virtue, sound judgment and character, capable of living within society. Such an education helps to create what Jürgen Habermas calls bonds of solidarity, the very foundations on which our societies rest and function. Retaining that broader focus in Catholic education at a time of ever more specialisation in education, and with the growth of sub-subject silos, especially in universities, can be challenging. But to remain authentic and countercultural, we must do so. Blessed John Henry Newman's idea of an education is that the learning takes place in amidst that breadth, in that interdisciplinary space. It broadens the horizon and the mind, and it forms character. Catholic education, ladies and gentlemen, is not to diminish the vocational dimension, but it is to ensure that it is balanced with a comprehensive academic formation which equips the student in the broadest possible human sense. So when Henry VIII, and then that other favourite of Irish history, Oliver Cromwell, conducted the dissolution of the monasteries, including Blackfriars, perhaps what they had failed to understand is that Catholicism is not defined by buildings, church land, shrines to saints, but is embodied in the human being and a life lived. As Pope Paul VI said, illuminated by faith. It is this focus on the whole person that defines the Catholic approach to education and imbues Catholic education with such strength and depth. That inner steel is what has enabled Catholicism and Catholic education to survive challenging times in the past. And though the challenges of the present and the future are likely to be different, we can be confident that the focus on the wider human dimension and the knowledge of what we have already weathered in these islands will ensure an ongoing, unique contribution to society. But that concept of Catholic education, ladies and gentlemen, must always engage in a particular context and in a prevailing culture. That brings me to the second point this evening, the contemporary culture. What is it, and how can our Catholic faith interact with it? What do we mean by culture? I'm relying, for the purposes of this evening's talk, on a very simple definition set out in the Cambridge English Dictionary, that culture is the way of life, especially the general customs and beliefs of a particular group of people at a particular time. Most of us are part of many cultural milieus, depending on where we live, our race, ethnicity, nationality, faith, belief, civilization, and the list could go on. We could have an entirely separate lecture about the definitions and applications of culture, but Father Aidan would be your speaker tonight and not me on that particular topic. Ladies and gentlemen, our domestic contemporary society, and indeed many parts of the world, but especially the Western world, is searching for a way to deal with ever more complex worlds of difference. This is particularly the case when it comes to faiths and religion, as societies struggle to deal with the question of what role faith plays or does not play in our respective societies. That is compounded by a growing diversity of faiths, and sometimes even questions about what constitutes a recognised religion and how to deal in a fair and equitable way with all faiths and beliefs and none. This is also taking place at a time, ladies and gentlemen, when regrettably our overall religious literacy in broader society seems to be at an all-time low. When the Prime Minister issued his Christmas greetings just last month, he yet again sparked a rather lively debate about whether the country was still a Christian country. People seemed to struggle with how to determine or measure if the country was still Christian. And 18 months ago, we also recall the investigations into attempts to influence the ethos of state schools in some parts of Birmingham, and the subsequent guidance coming from Ofsted about how to handle radicalisation in schools. And in the midst of all of this, there is also a broader debate about the role of faith schools in society and their overall contribution, and crucially, whether or not they should enjoy state subsidy. And in our contemporary culture, there is an increasingly loud and sometimes intolerant voice which would suggest that the only way to deal with this growing problem of religious complexity is through creating a more privatised form of religion, to push it out of the public sphere and into the private. They would have society believe at times that competing absolutist claims made by religions should be rejected, but with one notable exception, and that is the absolutist claim made by militant secularism itself, that it is somehow neutral and objective and should therefore be the norm or the benchmark by which society should function. So an offer, ladies and gentlemen, of a level playing field, one that claims to be neutral and fair and objective, could well seduce policymakers and politicians as they try to navigate the complexity of our culture and society. They could think, ladies and gentlemen, that they are grappling with unprecedented issues of complexity and diversity, most likely with a broad sweep of history they are not. Similar tensions gripped earlier generations as they faced the hurdle of building cohesive societies amidst a growing diversity that might have stretched the imagination of those who went before us to think of a wider cultural canvas than had hitherto been the case within what might have been up to that point very homogeneous societies. So from time to time, we should remind ourselves that such challenges to stretch the imagination to incorporate new groups into society is not new nor a stretch. 150 years ago, Ireland was quite a far away place from England, and the arrival of Irish immigrants in this society also asked people to stretch their imagination. Regulatory authorities too need to recall the difficulties faced by earlier generations in building community and integrating diversity into a cohesive society. For regulatory authorities, it might seem easier, when faced with competing interests, to roll back faith from the public sphere and impose a one-size-fits-all approach, arguing that it is neutral, fair, value for money for the taxpayer, etc. But that would raise another set of problems. Neutral from what, and fair to whom? In such a new era, whose values would prevail? There is also a risk, ladies and gentlemen, that faith communities themselves, when faced with this more intolerant climate, might retreat from navigating the complexity or promoting the distinctiveness of their offer, so they might favour just blending in. Pope Francis has cautioned us against just blending in. Speaking in Rome last June to a group of Italian school teachers, he said, "Education cannot be neutral. It is either positive or negative. Either it enriches or it impoverishes. Either it enables a person to grow or it lessens, even corrupts him. The mission of schools is to develop a sense of truth, of what is good and beautiful. That is not neutral. That is not blending in." In other words, ladies and gentlemen, simply blending in erodes the distinctiveness and the very raison d'etre for existence as a separate offering. Both approaches, blending in or rolling back, would be wrong, as they would greatly diminish a culturally rich and diverse society. So, to situate Catholic education in our culture, we must first determine what our culture is and what underpins it in this period. More specifically, we need to determine what type of polity do we live in or want, and how does it relate to faith? Is our culture a secular one which only sees a private role for faith in the wider society? Is it something which is confined to a Sunday? Is it an individual freedom to worship but without a collective dimension which is allowed to manifest itself in society? Will it be a world in which the state emerges with a monopoly on service provision and education at the expense of other societal providers? Will it be a world where faith providers can perhaps deliver a service but will not be able to call on official taxpayer funds to do so? Or is our world one which will be comfortable with a multiple number of service providers, with the state regulating the space to sustain acceptable minimum standards in service delivery and content? In such a world, regulator and service provider must find an accommodation which respects the proper role and remit of the other. To date, the latter model most resembles our society in the United Kingdom, but there is no guarantee that such a model will always prevail. Choices and priorities will always be looked at afresh by policymakers, and sometimes what can appear as a rather dry technical matter can have far-reaching consequences for society, the role of the individual in that society, the ability of organisations to engage and participate, and the very nature of state authority and control itself. But what guides our choices? There are competing views about the future of our society. Much of it revolves around the place of faith in the society. In education too, the debate rages about the role of faith schools. Why, is it asked, do taxpayers fund faith-based schools? Why are schools separated, or indeed segregated, as some would use the word, along faith lines? And how is that compatible with building one society? All relevant and hot questions, ladies and gentlemen, and too often as Catholics, we can wade into the practical responses without first re-examining the theoretical underpinnings. We can fail to examine the reasons things are as they are. The all-important historical context or philosophical tradition can be marginal at times, and it can become quite a polemical debate. And as Catholics, we can fall into that trap and divorce ourselves from our own intellectual traditions. Eventually, ladies and gentlemen, that can leave us grappling in the dark. And in recalling that intellectual tradition, we will illustrate the role for Catholic education of seeking out answers to some of the fundamental questions which challenge us in the contemporary period. At its heart, the effort must be to try to find a reconciling of what some might describe as that 2 centuries-old rupture between faith and reason which came about at the time of the Enlightenment. Healing such a rupture must see faith and reason as allies, not enemies, and the Enlightenment not as alien, but as something which grew from faith. For much of the past 2 centuries, we have thought of the Enlightenment as ushering in this rupture between faith and reason. Professor Charles Taylor, in a book that you will be familiar with, The Secular Age, said that Western modernity, including its secularity, is the fruit of new inventions. It should not be depicted as a rupture, but as an evolving story of human history, with the secular and the religious dimensions not juxtaposed, but emerging from the same story. One of the prophetic voices on this question, who sometimes is, or often is not listened to by broader society, in my view, is Pope Emeritus Benedict. Benedict has been writing for much of his life about the risks we face when we separate ourselves from all ethical traditions and rely exclusively on technological reasoning and its possibilities. It is no coincidence that perhaps in his cultural context as a teenager it continues to form him, and the fact that as a 16-year-old he was writing at a time when National Socialism was rampant across Germany. He writes, "This rationality can become devastating if it becomes detached from its roots and exalts technological feasibility as the sole criterion. The bond between the two great sources of knowledge, nature and history, is always necessary." Ladies and gentlemen, at a time when we are trying to decipher how to deal with those who use religion as a vehicle for their own violent agendas, there is perhaps never a better time to repeat Joseph Ratzinger's call for reason to be policing faith and faith policing reason. It is not an either-or situation. Ratzinger recognizes that there are pathologies of religion, but that there are also pathologies of reason. He wrote, "Faith in God, the idea of God, can be manipulated, and then it becomes destructive. This is the risk that religion runs. But reason that cuts itself off from God completely and tries to confine him to the purely subjective realm loses its bearings and thus opens the door to the forces of destruction." He continues, "Whereas the Enlightenment was searching for moral foundations that would be valid even if God did not exist, we must invite our agnostic friends today to be open to a morality as if God did exist. The risk is that by continuing with a rupture, and in the absence of any intellectual reconciliation in our society, our culture will remain adrift from its roots and history." Benedict has said there can be no peace in the world without genuine peace between reason and faith, because without peace between reason and faith, the sources of morality and law simply dry up. Ratzinger is one prophetic voice. There are others too who are highlighting the risk of that continued rupture. Alistair McIntyre characterizes this as Thomistic ideals coming up against Rousseauist ideals, and this lack of a common language or ability to reach consensus, he says, could lead to a Nietzschean immorality of total chaotic relativism. Jürgen Habermas and Doyen of the Frankfurt School echoed the point when he said, "It remains the case that liberal societal structures are dependent on the solidarity of their citizens. And if the secularization of society goes off the rails, the sources of this solidarity may dry up altogether. That," he says, "could well slacken the democratic bond and exhaust the kind of solidarity that the democratic state needs but cannot impose by law. It simply must evolve." This, he says, would lead to the transformation of the citizens of prosperous and peaceful liberal societies like our own to become isolated nomads, acting on the basis of their own self-interest, persons who used their subjective rights only as weapons against each other. But how to avoid a drying up of solidarity which serves to provide the glue of consensus and the basics which allow our society to exist and function? Again, Joseph Ratzinger provides a framework, and one which partly came from his dialogue in the early years of the millennium with Jürgen Habermas. It was his personal attempt to try to heal that rupture between faith and reason. For as you know, Habermas is a self-proclaimed agnostic, at times an atheist. He shifts. Benedict wrote, "It seems to me obvious today that secularism in itself is not an opposition to the faith. I would even say that it is a fruit of the faith, because the Christian faith was a universal religion from the very start and consequently could not be identified with any single state. It is present in all states and different in these states. It has always been clear to Christians that religion and faith are not politics, but another sphere of human life. Politics, the state, were not a religion, but rather a secular reality with a specific role, and the two must always be open to each other." He went on, "Only in these conditions of what he calls healthy secularity can a society be constructed in which diverse traditions, cultures, and religions peacefully coexist. To totally separate public life from all valuing of traditions means to embark on a closed, dead-end path." His healthy secularism, ladies and gentlemen, is a classic definition of pluralism. So what does all this mean in our cultural and political context? What role should faith play in our society, and how should it contribute? Through individual or collective action, or both? This evening I would suggest that our approach to faith and society, to the role of faith bodies in providing services, most notably education, is a product of a unique historical context and a philosophical tradition born out of that context. Our approach to faith bodies acting in society tells us something about our state and society. But we run the risk that if we do not know our own tradition sufficiently well and the particular context that gave birth to that tradition, then we might import a model which we think is similar or feasible, but is not a product of our particular cultural context. That could lead to a rupture in the relationship between state and society, of which the faith dimension over recent centuries has been a central part. In the face of complexity or challenge, we cannot abandon all too easily that which has served us well in recent centuries, and which we have arrived at often after painful and turbulent efforts for inclusion. Many states, including most Western states, would not tolerate non-state providers providing or delivering essential services such as education on behalf of the state. One can think of the French Republic, for example, which has probably the strictest separation constitutionally between church and state of any liberal democracy. But our history and tradition, ladies and gentlemen, is not that of 1789 and the French Revolution and the emergence of an all-powerful and dominant state which consumes society. Our approach here in these islands was achieved more through evolution than revolution, and one which accords faith a role, not a privatised role, in society. Why so? Because, ladies and gentlemen, the Enlightenment tradition that we often speak about is not a single tradition. There is not a single Enlightenment. The Enlightenment of 1789 is not the same as that of 1776. Confusing the two can create difficulties and can create contemporary policy confusion. The Continental and US Enlightenments differ most sharply when it comes to faith and its place in the society. Professor Gertrude Himmelfarb describes the French Enlightenment as one where reason was not just pitted against religion, defined in opposition to religion, it was granted the same absolutist dogmatic status as religion. The French Revolution was more of a belated reformation, not fought in the name of a different interpretation of religion, but for a different form of authority, a rather narrower, defined concept of reason. The Enlightenment in the English-speaking world, on the other hand, did not accord reason that preeminence, and religion was not the paramount enemy. As a result, the English-speaking world had an Enlightenment which was more compatible with a large spectrum of belief and disbelief. The effect on faith has been summed up as a continental Enlightenment, which was more about freedom from faith, to an American or English-speaking Enlightenment, which was more about a freedom for faith. Ladies and gentlemen, the policy choices we make will tell us something about the society we want to build and the role of the state within that society and its attitude to difference and the right to be different and the right to teach difference. History has shown us numerous examples of how impossible it is to divorce a culture from its past. How faith communities are treated can often be a litmus test for broader freedoms within the society and the place of the individual vis-à-vis the state. One can think of revolutionary France or the creation of the Soviet Union as examples of ruptures and of violent ruptures. Critiques by faith communities can help to reinforce democratic processes in liberal states by ensuring alternative perspectives are heard and groupthink is avoided. So a faith perspective not just helps the state through the provision of services, but helps to ensure the very plurality that helps to keep the state liberal. That means open to challenge. Without challenge, democratic states run the risk of becoming illiberal and fostering a culture of uniformity which can be unhealthy for the future of democracy. Western democracies, including the United Kingdom, need debate and vibrant differences to remain alive and to achieve renewal. It is their oxygen. A pluralist approach on the part of the state allows for a variety of voices and providers rather than a singularity of approach. A plural space will often be open to greater participation by religious groups and other organisations, and it will ensure a society that will tend to avoid authoritarian tendencies. A truly pluralist society will often be characterised by a weaker state, often acting as regulator, but open to a variety of providers meeting acceptable standards and contributing to the flourishing of a wider society. The belief in pluralism on the part of the state is not alien to the Catholic tradition. It is central to it, and it was enshrined again in the Second Vatican Council when it said, "It is the task of the state to see to it that all citizens are able to come to a suitable share in culture and are properly prepared to exercise their civic duties and rights. Therefore, the state must protect the right of children to an adequate school education, check on the ability of teachers and the excellence of their training, look after the health of the pupils, and in general promote the whole school project. But it must always keep in mind the principle of subsidiarity so that there is no kind of school monopoly, for this is opposed to the native rights of the human person, to the development and spread of culture, to the peaceful association of citizens, and to the pluralism that exists today in ever so many societies." In this meaning, pluralism is not just tolerance, but exchange and interest in the other. It is not relativism, but respecting distinctiveness. This definition of pluralism would allow, even encourage, groups to actively participate and engage in the society as individuals or through collective organisations, and would see them as contributing to the common good. This brings us to our final point this evening. Now that we have identified what we mean by Catholic education and what is its proper context, can it survive or indeed thrive? It all depends, ladies and gentlemen, on how the state sees itself with regard to broader society. If the state adopts a pluralist approach as set out above, then faith-based education can thrive. However, if the state sees itself as going down a more absolutist model to the detriment of wider society, then it is unlikely that state-funded faith schools or education will survive in their current form. And while that would be a regret due to the loss of state-funded faith schools, and a regret for the church in particular, it would be an even greater loss to society because of what it would signify, because society would lose some of its most core and basic freedoms at the expense of an ever-encroaching state. Ultimately, freedom would be impinged, societal and personal. So how do we avoid such a situation? How do we not only ensure the survival of faith schools, but the inherent freedoms that go along with them? We do so, ladies and gentlemen, by knocking down each of the arguments which are used to attack state-supported faith schools, and by placing the argument in the wide intellectual context in which these schools were first created. But the practical points need addressing too. We cannot ignore them. And here are some of those practical points. First, that faith schools breed hatred or mistrust. The self-styled Commission on Religion and Belief in Public Life published a report in December which addressed the issue of faith-based schools and admissions policies. The report stated, "In England, successive governments have claimed in recent years that faith schools and free schools create and promote social inclusion, which leads to cohesion and integration. However, in our view, it is not clear that segregation of young people into faith schools has promoted greater cohesion, or that it has not in fact been socially divisive and led rather to greater misunderstanding and tension." The report goes on to recommend that bodies responsible for school admissions should take measures to reduce selection on grounds of religion in state-funded schools. And I'm told, ladies and gentlemen, that at the press conference to launch the report, that yet again, Dame Butler Sloth cited the example of Catholic schools in Northern Ireland as a negative. Ladies and gentlemen, all too often I have heard even Catholic educators in Britain cede ground on this point. How many times do people cite the very existence of Catholic schools in Northern Ireland as if they were somehow the cause of the troubles and that they bred hatred and mistrust? Do you ever hear that coming from people with accents like mine? No, you don't. You mostly hear it from ill-informed individuals who have never experienced Catholic schools in Northern Ireland and the sterling work they did during the Troubles to hold the line and to prevent the society from slipping into civil war. It can be convenient for some, perhaps middle-class secularists, to blame religion and particularly the Catholic Church for the Troubles. It sort of exonerates them from their responsibility for ignoring sectarianism over the decades and the impact it had on keeping a population down because of its faith and national identity. In my experience, I don't know of anyone who was radicalised by what they were taught in a Catholic school in Northern Ireland. I went to one throughout my life. However, I know many who were challenged each day to think morally and to act courageously. And the church in that time never flinched from its transmission of a strong moral code regarding the taking of human life. And ladies and gentlemen, nor is it just in Northern Ireland. Recent research by Professor Duncan Morrow on Scotland's Catholic schools showed that they did not cause sectarianism. And as I witnessed firsthand in Pakistan, many Christian schools and Catholic schools with a majority of Muslim students are at the forefront of interfaith witness and have been for decades. The second charge. We are told that faith schools are not representative of wider society and tend to serve privilege. The most recent statistics for the Catholic schools sector in England show the following. Catholic schools are more ethnically diverse than the national average, and they take more students from deprived areas. 20% of pupils at Catholic secondary schools lived in the most deprived areas, compared to a national average of 17%. 33.5% of pupils in Catholic primary schools are from ethnic minority backgrounds, compared to a national average of 27%. And Pope Francis, in his teaching, is challenging us to go even further and to be at the forefront of reaching beyond the privileged and to be agents of social change. He said, "The greatest failure of education is to only educate within walls. The walls of selective culture, the walls of a culture of security, and the walls of a social class. We must be willing to take risks as educators and teach beyond the walls, being more merciful and inclusive." The third charge, about our results, and we need to trumpet the success of Catholic schools academically, and why that is so. Catholic schools have a higher number of Ofsted-ranked good or outstanding marks, and students score higher in GCSEs and SATs than the national average. And why? It is, ladies and gentlemen, because of the wider values and the distinct philosophy of education. The fourth charge. We are told that faith schools are ghettos, which undermine cohesion in society by segregating people on religious difference. Between the Catholic Church and Church of England, they provide close to a quarter of all state school provision in England. And far from being ghettos, Catholic schools in England have just over 70% of students coming from a Catholic background and 55% of the teaching staff. Catholic schools, ladies and gentlemen, are part of the widest global network of education found anywhere in the world. Each day, the Catholic Church alone is educating over 60 million children, crossing many languages, cultures, and nationalities. So how do we thrive? We thrive by taking on the arguments one by one, and with solid evidence and rigour. But we also must do more to thrive. We must retain conviction about the offer of Catholic education and its purpose and contribution to society. The constant integration of the ethos with the educational philosophy will remind all concerned of the broader goals of Catholic education. Retaining that integration requires constant attention. Getting the balance right all the time will not always be easy, especially with pressures from within a professional educational culture that rightly demands ever more inputs and data to be able to measure impact and value for money for the taxpayer. But the Catholic school or university needs to be as attentive to its ethos and identity as it is to the essential professional metrics. Otherwise, it runs the risk of cutting itself off from its roots and hence its distinctive offer, or to borrow that Habermas phrase, of drying up. In conclusion, I set out this evening to argue that Catholic education can thrive in this era. But to do so, it must know what it is. It must know what the contemporary culture is. It must take on the arguments and not retreat from them. And it must not shy away from offering something radically distinctive. We must also set the argument in its widest context and show that it is not just about state funding for faith schools, important as that is to the life of the church and society, but it goes much broader than that and touches the very notion of freedom within our society. Within that context, faith-based educational institutions should always make a distinctive offering to the society which complements other providers in that educational space. That too is pluralism. Of course, to operate a hybrid model between the church and the state in any cultural context will always prove challenging. Complexity always is. But engagement and participation is always preferable to isolation and marginalisation, both for state and church. Provided one does not lose its independence or distinctiveness, then this is a fantastic model on which we can build. The pluralist context in the United Kingdom has given us a wonderful faith-based education system. It is a system that evolved and depends on a very delicate equilibrium which must be promoted, explained, and if need be, defended from time to time in the political and public arena. It is not without its tensions and challenges, but it remains a fine example of a contract within a pluralist society between state and faith, which works to the benefit of both, but most of all, to its citizens. It has the potential to answer a much-needed response to our contemporary culture as we struggle to define and build cohesive communities. Ladies and gentlemen, it has worked for previous generations, including the Catholic community, and it can work now for other communities as well. We must avoid the temptation to be complacent about its future, or smug about its achievements, or even to retreat when we get a robust intellectual challenge. Pope Francis said, "Do not withdraw from the world, but be active in it." We should always believe that the opportunities to serve the greater good and society are much stronger than the challenges, and that even the challenges, even the robust challenges, will help us to remain agile and to refresh our offer and reacquaint ourselves with our own intellectual tradition of why things are as they are. If we do that, ladies and gentlemen, then everything is to play for, and we can reinvigorate our contribution to wider society by ensuring a thriving and vibrant Catholic contribution to education and the protection of pluralism and our wider freedoms within that society. Thank you very much.